Hello and welcome to the TES podcast. I'm senior editor Simon Locke, and today I'm bringing you the first in a two-part wellbeing special. These two bonus episodes consist of conversations I've had recently with two experts in the field of student and staff mental health, during which I asked them to explain what actually works when it comes to wellbeing. In today's episode, I meet Willem Kuyken, Professor of Mindfulness and Psychological Sciences at Oxford University, where we discuss the wellbeing challenges facing schools in September and how leaders can hope to overcome them. In our next episode, I'll be meeting Jamie Smith, Director of Mental Health and Wellbeing in schools at the Anna Freud Centre, and asking her what leaders can do to rejuvenate and retain their teachers after a fraught 18 months. Both of my guests will be speaking at this year's EACT Ideas Conference in partnership with TES on the 7th of October. To find out more and register for this free event, visit eact.org.uk/conference. Willem Kuyken has spent the majority of his academic career focusing on evidence-based approaches to depression, in particular how mindfulness-based programs can help boost mental health. He is coming to the end of a seven-year study into the use of mindfulness in schools, looking at the mental health of 28,000 students. He still found the time to welcome me to his home in Oxford to discuss what really works when it comes to wellbeing. Willem, thank you so much for joining me today and inviting us into your home for our first, I think this is our first in-person interview for what seems like a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
My pleasure. And welcome.
on that note, the fact that there's been so much disruption over the last 18 months, I think that's quite poignant and ties into what we're speaking about today. There's been a huge amount of disruption for schools, for pupils. Mm-hmm. What impact will that have had on wellbeing, and what sort of problem will schools face in September, do you think?
I think it's a really mixed picture for wellbeing. I think one of the things that the pandemic has exposed is that we actually had something of a pandemic of problems with wellbeing in young people before the COVID-19 pandemic. Some 18 to 20% of kids before the pandemic had mental health problems that were significant. And it's, I think, a mixed picture now. What we've seen in terms of well-being is that for some groups of people, it's got worse. And for other groups of people, they've actually done just fine through the pandemic. And that's for a whole range of complex reasons, I think. Children that have been in families that are struggling with unemployment and deprivation, it's been a really hard time for them. Kids who maybe were exposed to bullying at school, being back at home, has actually been a respite, and they've done just fine. So I think it's a really mixed picture, with some things clearly getting worse, depression and anxiety for the population as a whole, but other things showing some evidence that people are getting better. So rates of, I think, self-injury, there's some evidence that's gone down during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. There's undeniably going to be a focus on academic catch-up, and perhaps there already is. How much of a focus do you think well-being and sort of those students who have struggled, catching them up to sort of get their well-being back to where it should be? What sort of focus will that be for schools?
I think the separation out of well-being and academic outcomes is really unhelpful. I think it's a zero-sum game to think of these as being separate pursuits, that actually if one spends time on well-being, then you don't have the time for maths, English core subjects. I think they really go completely hand in hand. For a child to learn, he needs to feel safe. I think as Marcus Rashford has really shown leadership, they need to be fed. They need to feel that they are seen and heard. All of these are parts of well-being. So it's not something that is a zero-sum game or even something that's over here. I think it needs to be completely integrated. And one of the things, my sense from the science, but also from what I hear from teachers, is that well-being needs to be thought of as something that is in the fabric of every moment of the school day. It's not something that's done in the PHSC lessons, but it's woven into every interaction, every meeting, every classroom, so that it becomes part of the underpinning fabric of the school day, moment by moment.
Mm-hmm. And if schools are taking that approach and increasingly sort of bringing well-being into the school day, the research around it can be sort of convoluted, and there's conflicting research, and I think schools are getting very good at using research when it comes to their teaching, but perhaps is there some room to improve when it comes to research in its relation to wellbeing, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, for sure. It's very interesting because most of my professional work has been in the health service up until about 10 years ago. And in the health service, we have NICE, which is a body that looks at the evidence base, and the sorts of things that are then introduced in the health service are through systematic reviews and meta-analyses of what works and is it cost-effective. So the sort of things that are delivered in hospitals and in primary care will be things that have met NICE thresholds for the treatment of depression or anxiety or cancer or anything else. And schools don't operate that same system. They tend to introduce things that are perhaps of the moment, that there is a kind of an enthusiasm for. And I wonder whether actually, and I know that's happening with education of academic outcomes, but if that were to happen more with wellbeing, I think schools could make a lot of inroads. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think you're right that the research is quite mixed, but there are a few things that I think are really good for schools to know. One is around school climate, school ethos. There is a fairly good, robust evidence base that the climate or the ethos of a school, a sense of safety, a sense of positive relationships between staff and the senior leadership team, between the teachers and the kids, a sense of a well-organized school, this kind of school climate is associated with young people's well-being and mental health outcomes. Between 1% and 6% of the variance in young people's mental health outcomes can be explained through school climate. So creating a positive school ethos, a positive school climate around well-being, I think is one thing that schools can do. There are some programs that we know are effective and the evidence base bears out. The Incredible Years program is a program that's got a really robust evidence base, primarily focused on classroom management. But that's an example of where people have gone out and really carefully looked at the evidence. And that is a program that I think stacks up as a program that schools might want to invest in. Mm.
So from your experience, is it when schools are implementing sort of wellbeing initiatives, is it something that is part of the school day and timetabled? Or do you think it's more about, it sounds like it's more about culture and something that's overarching rather than, okay, it's an hour on a Thursday or something like that. Is that the case, do you think?
There is a really quite large body of work, and I come at it more from a sort of scientist, rather than an educationalist point of view, but there's quite a large body of work suggesting that how things are implemented into a school makes a massive difference, and it's a whole range of different factors. One is it takes time. You can't just decide one academic year, we're going to do something next year. It's probably a 5-10 year window to systematically introduce something really high quality into a school. I think another is that it involves top-down and bottom-up influences. Mm-hmm. So the school leadership team, the governors, the head need to buy into whatever you're doing. But you also need champions on the ground amongst the pupil body and amongst the teacher body. And those champions are the ones who I think, if you like, will be the influencers who will shift the student body, shift the teacher body. You also need to balance something about the integrity of the initial program with flexibility. So the way research works is that you research a program and then you find that it works. If you then dilute that program as you bring it into a school, it may no longer work. Mm. But on the other hand, if you don't consider that within this school, for example, the proportion of free school meals or the children for whom English is not their first language are major issues, then that lack of flexibility could also impair it. So the whole business of implementing something, making it a sustainable part of a school, is a complex business, and good senior leadership teams, good heads understand that.
With that in mind, what would you say to sort of leaders who perhaps worried about staff buy-in? I guess some might think that there's an academic trade-off when you talk about well-being initiatives. How does that work? What would you say to leaders who are thinking, had reservations perhaps?
I think I'd go back to this idea that it's not a zero-sum game. that a head that understands that her or his well-being is really important for them to come into school and do their job every day is somebody who will see the same value for their teachers, that those teachers' well-being needs to be looked after. And if those teachers understand that, that will also spiral down to the kids. I think a teacher who doesn't look after themselves will burn out. The same is true for a head. And nobody is served, particularly the children aren't served by that. So I just think it's a really false dichotomy. I think it's something about changing the culture and changing the ethos. And I personally feel very strongly that there's something very interesting happening in the world just now. That as we come out of this pandemic, there is actually an opportunity to do something of a reappraisal of what's really important and what makes a difference. So I'm in my early 50s, and my grandfather died in his early 50s of a heart attack. And this was a long time ago. And he ate a lot of red meat. He never exercised. He smoked regularly, smoked in front of children. That was absolutely the norm. If he had been born 50 years later, he wouldn't have done any of those things, and his high blood pressure would have been spotted, and he would have lived differently. So there has been a massive cultural shift towards smoking, towards exercise, towards red meat, and towards diet generally. And I think we have an extraordinary opportunity just now to think about a similar kind of shift in ethos around well-being. Well-being isn't something different, or it's about looking after sort of foundational skills of relationships, of realizing potential, of flourishing. And I think that sits alongside learning academic topics and learning other other things that children learn in schools.
That's a really, really good point. I think you mentioned that perhaps we were already in a pandemic of poor well-being for young people before COVID-19 arrived. Is there enough research out there that tells us what works and what doesn't? I guess when it comes to academic areas, teaching and learning, there's a huge body of research as what works. Where are we at in terms of well-being? And from your experience, do we have an idea of what works, what doesn't, or what do we need from the research in future to kind of build a picture of that?
I think that's a really good point, and I think we absolutely need really high quality research that answers the questions of what well-being initiatives, programs are effective, for whom are they effective, how are they effective, and how can they be implemented in a sustainable long-term way. Now that's large scale important research. So we've just done that over the last 7 years with a universal schools-based mindfulness intervention. So we've tried to answer those questions. How can this be implemented? Is it effective? For whom is it effective? How can it be a sustainable intervention over the long term? I would say in a few areas that's happened. The Incredible Years program is a good example of that. I think the work on school climate is a good example of that. But you're absolutely right. There's a huge amount of work still to be done in this area.
Are there any, some people might see well-being as something, a sort of a bolt-on, something, as I mentioned, detracting from the academic side of things. Are there things that schools are implementing that are doing more harm than good, or perhaps ineffective? And schools are sort of, well-being became a little bit of a buzzword at the times and was added to the Ofsted framework. Are there things that you've seen schools roll out that aren't effective and should be avoided?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a recent trial from Judy Kidger of mental health literacy training, which was a negative trial, suggesting that it didn't have the effects it was thought to have. And I think the reason we're doing the research around mindfulness that we're doing is because I think the enthusiasm ran ahead of the evidence. So I think there are probably a lot of programs where that is the case. And I think it probably isn't helpful for me to name them, because actually, in a way, the evidence may still bear out interesting ways in which they are effective. But I think the business of stopping and pausing for these programs and really looking at the evidence, and if a head teacher or a senior leadership team doesn't have the skills to do that, finding somebody who does. Because I think it's a really good investment of time, because it takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of cultural change to bring something into a program. And I think it's something that needs, and good head teachers and good senior leadership teams, I think, understand that and know that.
Yes. I think you mentioned that some initiatives might work for certain types of pupils, perhaps from disadvantaged backgrounds. Mm-hmm. How much can we dig into that? With teaching and learning, for example, we would say, you know, what works for one student might not work for another. Are there similar things when it comes to wellbeing in that respect? Could you sort of carry out wellbeing interventions with particular pupils?
Yeah, for sure. So the area that I know best is around sort of cognitive behavioural and mindfulness-based interventions. And I think in a classroom and with kids, if the behaviour problems are such that you can't actually teach, then that's the place to start, right? So we have classroom behaviour management programmes, that's the place to start, to support the teachers to do that. I think then there are also issues around kids' ability to focus, that attentional control and focus. And I think there are some interventions that can be used just to help kids to focus and to pay attention. Again, good teachers perhaps kind of intrinsically know about those, but there are, I think, formal interventions that can be used. And I think beyond that, then there are sort of behavioural and social and emotional programs that can be used. But if you don't have classroom management and then the ability to pay attention, then those other things, I think, they're unlikely to take hold. And I think the other thing that, certainly in the mindfulness field, that really needs to be thought about very carefully, and I suspect this is true with many social emotional programs, is the extent to which the children and the teachers and the wider community around the school buy in to whatever you're doing. If the children don't value or see it as being something credible, then I think you're moving against the tide. That needs to be a place to start, is to really see what you're doing from the children's perspective, to meet them where they're at. And I think, again, really good programs know how to do that.
Mm. Yeah, is there a danger that these things aren't given enough focus? They're sort of brought in as not a tick box exercise, but something that's, you know, given an hour a fortnight, and then actually there's no point. Kids don't value it, and there's not enough time given to these topics.
I think that's exactly right. So I think we've seen that with sort of programs that address bullying or programs that address behaviour problems in classrooms. They have to be part of the whole culture of the school. All the teachers need to be working together to those same objectives. An anti-bullying lecture once a term, it has to be into the fabric of the whole school with all the teachers working in concert. And then I think you see evidence that these things can be effective.
I think, your body of research has been around, a lot of it has been around mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about that, if I may. Sure. For someone coming from outside of this sphere, I guess, could you define what you mean by mindfulness?
Yeah, I think mindfulness is, in its simplest form, is a natural capacity that we all have to pay attention to our experience in a particular way, with a sort of curiosity and with kindness and with care. That's its sort of simplest definition, but I think it's a word a little bit like wisdom or beauty or love or art. It's got lots of different facets. And I think an expression that a lot of people resonate with is an expression that between stimulus and response, there is a space. And if we can access that space, then we've got a choice and we've got the potential for freedom. So, for example, if you think about a teacher who is managing a classroom and there is a child with real behavior problems and that child kicks off in the classroom, that's the stimulus. If that teacher is really tired and feeling quite stressed and it's been a long day, it is so understandable and so easy for that teacher to react and react in maybe a way that they regret afterwards. So what mindfulness can do for those teachers is to create just a sense of presence and ability just to perhaps come back into their body. And that's enough space to say, what would be a wise, a skillful, a helpful response in this moment? How can I draw on my previous teaching experience, what I know about classroom management, to respond to this young person in a different way? And I think that's where mindfulness starts to sort of, the rubber hits the road, if you like. That it's not about an internal, obviously it is about an internal relationship with one's experience, but it's much more about how that is then used in our relationships, in our day-to-day work, in how we approach teaching, about our values. So it can become a sort of much larger thing.
And from your research, does this sort of approach get results? I know you're part of an ongoing study at the moment, but that's not been concluded yet. But previously, it did sort of practicing mindfulness. What effects have you seen?
It's a great question, and I think there is no doubt that mindfulness skills are associated with well-being. And that kind of, in a way, is a bit obvious. It's a bit like my grandfather and diet and exercise. So the ability to focus, the ability to regulate our emotions, the ability to respond in ways more aligned with our values, of course that's going to be associated with our well-being. When you look at formal mindfulness-based programs, there is, I think, really nice evidence now that it helps with adults with the prevention of depression. So the NICE guidelines recommend that, and it's widely available in the NHS. Called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And there is, I think, really good evidence that mindfulness-based programs can help with chronic pain. They can help people create a space between the stimulus of pain and how they are reacting to the pain. So there's a really strong evidence base there. And there is, I would say, emerging evidence in other areas. Coming into the educational sphere, I think one of the places where the evidence is strongest is actually with teachers. Our own and other people's work, I think, has consistently demonstrated that when teachers learn mindfulness, their levels of stress go down, their levels of well-being go up, and their ability to meet their work and to meet their children with a greater sense of kindness and compassion goes up as well. And I think given the key place of teachers within schools, I think that's a really important finding.
Do you think in that case there's a space for sort of being sort of teacher-led on this? So if you sort of create mindful teachers, there's a sort of trickle-down effect into the classroom, and it's sort of like you were talking earlier about that building that culture.
Yes.
Is that perhaps a more effective way to go?
Absolutely. I think if we had a mindful head teacher, we're more likely to have mindful teachers. And if we have mindful teachers, we're more likely to have mindful children. I think there's no doubt about that. And by the word mindful, I mean just the ability to regulate ourselves, the ability to meet stressful moments with a sense of spaciousness, a sense of, you know, it's not, obviously it's hard, but these are foundational skills, I think, that will spiral out to improve the outcomes for children.
Have you seen any effective ways that schools are doing that sort of thing? Have you seen mindful head teachers creating mindful leadership teams and so on? Have you seen that, and what does that look like?
Yeah, I have seen that. And, you know, we published a small study where we did case studies of different schools. And there was one school where it has been going on for, I'm going to say, somewhere close to 10 years. And I think everything that I've talked about so far was present. So I think the head and the senior leadership team were fully on board. There were champions within the school. And the champions were people who really had key places within the school. So, for example, in the student body, the young man who was the champion was somebody who was very well respected within the student body. So his voice carried a lot of weight. And I think the same is true within the teachers, so that actually within the teacher community, those champions are teachers who can, I think, influence the other teachers. They got really good skills at bringing something into the culture and into the mainstream of the school. And I think they are playing a long game, that they realise this isn't just about this year, it's about subsequent years as well. And I think this one of the schools I'm thinking of, it has become one of the unique selling points of that school. So when parents and students think about that school, they think about this as being one of its facets, a focus on the well-being and really taking care of the school. One of the things I've as I say, I'm a scientist rather than an educationalist, but my own experience of schools and of talking to teachers and doing research in schools is a lot of people resonate with this statement, is that when you walk into a school and spend a day in a school, you get a sense of the culture and the atmosphere of this school. Is it buzzy? Is it calm? Does it care about the safety of its teachers and children, or does it feel unsafe? And that is what I mean by culture. And I think being able to shift that to a place that supports well-being and supports learning, I think that's one of the tasks. And I know how hard that is, particularly in areas where kids are coming in not having had breakfast and levels of deprivation are very high and rates of turnover in the staff group are high. So, I really do understand that this is a very big challenge for many heads and senior leadership teams and schools.
Mm. I realise it's too early to talk about your research, as the findings haven't been published yet, but I think you've got some data already that you're happy to talk about.
Yep. So one of the papers that we published earlier this year was looking at the mental health and well-being of all of the children in our trial. So that's 28,000 children in 85 schools across the country. And we learned a few things from that. The first thing that we learned was that rates of depression and anxiety are in excess of 20%, so significant. The second thing that we learned is that schools' climate is associated with mental health and well-being. But the thing that I found quite sobering, and I think might be very reassuring for schools, is that the association or the amount of variance in the children's mental health and well-being that was carried by schools was only between 1.5 and 2.5%. That actually Marcus Rashford was right. That so much of the variance in mental health and well-being of children is coming from forces outside of the school. The deprivation that they live in, the adversity they're facing at home, their kind of backgrounds, their upbringing up to that date. So it's not to say that schools can't make a difference to well-being, but actually it's okay to have some modesty and some humility about that, because there are some wider social issues that maybe policymakers should be looking at that are outwith the control of schools.
Of course, yeah. With that in mind, and perhaps with the pressure being relieved a little bit, what would you say to school leaders heading into September, thinking that perhaps well-being is something they need to address? What would your sort of top tips be?
I think schools probably already have a lot on their plates in September, and rather than introduce a whole raft of new well-being measures, I wonder whether it might make a lot more sense for heads and senior leadership teams to look at the things that they're already doing, that they know teachers like, that the young people like, and maybe working with those and maybe tuning those up and just weaving them more into the culture of the whole school, and leaving more systematic large-scale interventions for when there's a bit more space and a bit more time for reflection. That being said, I do know that uncertainty and threat are two things that drive anxiety. And I think schools and teachers and head teachers can do an awful lot to work with uncertainty and threat. Now, obviously, there is real uncertainty, but actually, if the schools and the teachers can create a sense of safety and as much certainty as possible, that could do a huge amount, I think, for levels of anxiety and levels of confidence and safety as children and their parents move back into the next academic year.
Yeah, certainly think that's something we can all benefit from going forward, a lack of the uncertainty. So hopefully that continues. But Willem, thank you so much for speaking to me today and welcoming me into your home. All the best. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It's my pleasure.